The misconception that entrepreneurs have, usually at the beginning, is that they need a big TAM, a big target market. Okay, they don't. What they need is a clear path to eventually have a big target market, but at the beginning, they need to focus on a very small one. Okay, so it's very counterintuitive in that way, is that, Swan, as you mentioned, could serve almost any business on planet Earth. That's amazing. That's super powerful. And that means that eventually we can grow into a massive company. But if you start serving all these customers from day one, then you'll end up, giving a 60% service to all of them, right? So why don't you focus on a specific segment to give them a 100%,
You're listening to Zero to One, the podcast where future unicorns get a start. Every week, we sit down with the founders actually building, the ones turning scrappy ideas into real-world companies. No fluff, no cliches, just raw insights, hard lessons, and the playbooks that VCs and top operators don't share publicly. We're your hosts, Jonathan, Matteo, and Gary, three friends obsessed with turning zero into one. Ready to build something legendary? Let's dive in.
So today on Zero to One, we are joined by Amos Bar-Joseph, CEO and co-founder of Swan AI, an agent-powered go-to-market platform scaling to 30 million ARR with just three founders and zero employees. A two-time founder and former KPMG advisor, Amos is pioneering a new GTM model where intelligent agents handle everything from outreach to meeting prep, so founders can focus on closing high-leverage deals, not managing teams. How are you, Amos? Nice having you today on the bus, on the podcast.
Thank you, Matteo, for that introduction. That's amazing. If I could just take you with me to like every social gathering and have you introduce me, that would be my dream.
It will be a pleasure. Trust me, I cannot dream for something better. But first, can you maybe introduce yourself to our listeners who may not be familiar with Swan, as well as your background?
Yeah, so what you just said, it's hard to overcome that, Matteo. But from a personal perspective, it's not my first rodeo. I've built two companies before, based on the old startup playbook, the unicorn growth at all cost playbook that. Maybe some of you that are listening are familiar with that. Maybe some of you are, read about it in the books or in the kind of like a TechCrunch article or something like that. But basically, it means that you raise a big fat seed round before you get to product market fit. And then you scale to 30 people before you get to your first $1 million in revenue. And then beyond that, you try to brute force your way from round to round, expanding your vision more than your revenues each time. I really grew sick or tired of that, playbook. And I felt like it kind of like yields very inefficient companies. And I see a lot of good friends, young people who are going after that playbook and are losing and just, going back to their jobs, basically. So together with this concept of AI agents, I realized that, it's time to rewrite the playbook of how you build a business in an AI native world. And so Swan is, basically a journey to discover that, new playbook of how can you scale with intelligence, not with headcount. And it's a journey where we're building in public, we're documenting it. We try to get to $10 million ARR per employee, basically. That's what we're focusing on as an amazing sign for, agentic scaling, basically. And would love to tell more about the product, what we're building, how we're getting there, and things like that, guys. Success.
Such a great vision. And so let's say unusual, but getting more and more common to see a lot of people like trying to build like kind of lifestyle businesses, I'd say, but still with the ambition of a unicorn company, an older, the older playbook of unicorn type companies. But so how do you go from that idea into like, because Swan is only 6 months old, as I know. How did I start? How did I start? You mean your founder, your co-founders? Like, how did you, let's say, like, okay, we feel the tech is ready, and like, was it like a, what was the momentum or the shift that made you say, okay, we're just gonna do it now? Why now and not in 2 years when the tech is maybe more ready? Or I don't know.
Yeah. So first of all, like quick context on what is Swan, what are we selling basically, and then how do we get there? So Swan, you can think of it as Lovable for go-to-market. Those who are familiar with Lovable. It's basically an AI go-to-market engineer. So it's an engineering resource that sits, you know, under the sales and marketing departments and basically helps them to turn any go-to-market idea into an agentic workflow, into an AI workflow, basically. So they could, you know, scale revenue with intelligence, not headcount, and, you know, iterate on their ideas just using prompts, super fast, super efficient, instead of building these complex workflows for weeks using their own systems. And we didn't start specifically there. It's not like that was crystal clear from day one. And, you know, 99% of the great ideas that, you know, amazing companies are built on are not, you know, identical to the ideas that these founders start. And that was the same story of Swan. What we realize is that, you know, there's an AI agent revolution that is coming to go to market. And we didn't know exactly how it's going to unfold. What we tried doing is instead of, you know, falling in love with a specific idea, building an MVP for that idea, and then taking that MVP and try to sell it, et cetera, and, you know, take, you know, a process that takes months over months to validate each idea, we actually reversed the funnel. That's how I believe that great companies should start, is that we started generating demand and selling first before we had a product. We actually offered services at the beginning, but we like wrapped it under a product wrapper basically, but it was like manual services that we offered. And that really enabled us to move super fast because we were, you know, if we sold something to a customer, like, you know, a lead generation agent that could help them, you know, just, you know, generate leads or personalized emails. So basic email agents that we thought could solve a specific challenge for them. We just said, we tried selling them. They bought it. We said, amazing, that's a good sign. Then let's try to deliver it in a services way, basically without building a product. So we used no code automations and we were actually, you know, went over the results of the AI before sending it to the customer or things like that. It was all extremely manual, but we were able to iterate super fast until we realized, you know, okay, Swan, this is something that people want to buy and we can deliver in a scalable way. And that's how we kind of like, you know, zoned in on that.
Great.
What made you, what convinced you that like you should follow this playbook of first selling and then delivering and like, you know, building an MVP?
Yeah. So today, the simplest thing to do is to build a product. The hardest thing to do is to sell a product. We're basically, you know, the startup playbook where it was invented, you know, in the late 2000s, basically. And, you know, Eric Rice wrote the book on MVP in 2009, approximately. And at that time, you know, building tech was complex. And, you know, it was designed on the fact that, you know, instead of spending all that time in, you know, investing it in building the product, try to build an MVP, the smallest version you can actually build and then go and sell it. But today we're living in a world where, you know, building a product is extremely easy and it's just going to get easier and easier and easier with these no code apps, et cetera. And the only thing that is constant, that is a zero sum game, is attention. Basically, attention of the buyer is a scarce resource that you're fighting over. And so the more solutions out there in the market, the more people are fighting over attention of the buyer, the more the harder it gets to get them, basically. And so we realized that, you know, starting with the MVP doesn't make sense because that's the easy part to crack the MVP. What you need to first crack is the demand and sales. So if you're able to generate demand and you're able to sell to that demand a specific value proposition, you won. All you need is to develop the product. That's the easiest part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. And about the demand, you know, what was like, can you walk us through your first AI agent and what made you start, and what are the reasons that made you start with this AI agent, particularly this specific use case? Yeah.
So actually, the way that we work here was a little bit different, because I was able to generate demand without a specific value proposition tied to it. So the way that you, Matteo, and Jonathan heard about Swan is not really from what we're selling. It's more about, you know, the story of the autonomous business and the autonomous go-to-market organization. And basically, that story, that narrative helped me create demand in a consistent way. That demand came to Swan. And then I was able to say, you know what? What if we could sell you X? And they said, interesting, I would buy. Or no, I won't buy that, right? So first of all, you know, when you're focused on that, you can just generate demand in a way that is not tied to your value proposition. So you can change value propositions without losing the demand, basically. And so that's how we went about it at Swan. You know, we started from a very simple hypothesis that, you know, SDR work is, you know, very repetitive and cumbersome and requires a lot of resources, but it's also simple. And so an agent could actually replicate a lot of that work. But the thing is that, first of all, it was not a unique insight. And, you know, if you're thinking of starting a company and you're an entrepreneur, you need to understand that if your insight is not extremely unique, then it's not worth a company to build upon, basically. So the thing is with insights is that the more common they are, the more means that, you know, everyone could build this type of company. So why isn't there a company like that? And if it's new, it means that either a big company will just take that piece, or you will fight with hundreds of thousands of other players who are doing it. And you will just, you know, get commoditized and lose. So you need to find a unique insight that you only you understand, only you encounter it because you have a very lucky coincidence. You were working at a specific place and you saw the future in some way, or you're spending your time in a very boring place where no one likes to actually spend their time. And you actually saw that for that specific boring space, they actually have a specific challenge. So you don't need to be the only person in the world, but you need to understand, you need to look at it from that point of view, like how unique is my insight that I'm actually trying to build a company on. And our first insight wasn't that unique. A lot of companies are trying to build like these AI SDR solutions. That's how we started. But what we realized pretty soon is that when you try to implement these AI agent solutions and go to market, it's very hard for the companies to adopt it because every company has their own unique uses, basically. And that company wants it a little bit like that, and that company wants it a little bit like that, et cetera. And what we realize is that the valuable piece here, it's not the AI SDR, it's the AI go-to-market engineer, that piece of software that could customize an AI agent to your specific needs. And it doesn't have to be an AI SDR, it could be a BDR, it could be an account executive, it could do a lot of different works. But what you'd really need is to take a piece of technology and customize it to your unique go-to-market motion. That was the unique insight that led us to build Swan and to explode on that, because not a lot of companies are iterating on building AI SDRs or are understanding the challenges of implementing AI SDRs, right? So that was kind of like a unique insight that we realized that is worth building a company on.
And so Swan, to just sum up, is basically your, how you communicate with Swan is just like through natural language. So let's say I'm a user, I want to use Swan, I'm just going to tell him, hey Swan, or hey, it's Jonathan, and I just want to sell this service or this to or this product to this ICP, let's say. And so Swan is going to do all that go-to-market work of like finding the top of the funnel, the prospects, and sending him the emails and then adding them to specific workflows? Or how's that going to work specifically?
Close. So close, but not there enough. So Swan is a Slack app. It lives in Slack. You just add added a coworker to your Slack organization and you work with it in Slack. And you build like a specific playbook, actually. It's not about just taking care of everything, just do it, go, and you can do whatever you'd like. It's more like, for example, look, Swan, I have a list of, you know, people that registered for my webinar and my CRM. Okay, I want you to research them, qualify them, find, you know, their contact details and write a personalized message to each one of them and send them, you know, a LinkedIn, you know, DM, right? So that's how you can use Swan. It's more for a specific workflow that you have in mind that, you know, leverages your, you know, first party data, which is data in your CRM, leverages third party data that we have connection to, like, you know, firmographics and contact data, et cetera, and these AI capabilities. And you kind of like, you know, fuse them together into something like that. And more use cases could be every time that someone, you know, requests a demo, qualify them, you know, and route them to the right rep. If it's a VC, actually, route it, send me a Slack DM, I'm the CEO, I want to hear about VCs, right? So it can be something simple as that as well.
Well, how did you realize that, like, you should build that on top of Slack? Like, what was the, because from my experience, I don't know that much, like, applications that are built on top of Slack like this. Like, what was the unique insight that led you to build on top of Slack?
Yeah. When you're building a new tool, you're trying to sell a company a new tool, you're fighting against, you know, the inertia of their workflows, okay? Like, they are accustomed to do something. That's how they work. And to tell them, wait, you should change the way you work and go to my app, that is a big ask, very, very big ask. And you should avoid that at every possible way that you can, is to change their workflow. You want to live at the beginning inside of their workflow. And only after you got embedded into their day-to-day in kind of like in a way that is almost invisible to them and they don't need to change any habits or anything, then you can start directing them to go to your app as well, right? But we knew that, you know, especially sellers, they have like a very repetitive daily routine and they're used to working in the same way. So we don't want to disrupt that, basically. So that was one that, you know, insight that led us to understand, okay, it got to be, you know, within their workflow. That doesn't equal Slack. Why Slack? It's because we actually believe that Slack is the best place for AI agents to live because it's a conversational interface. And so it's already built. You get so many out-of-the-box features that you need for AI agents, the ability to communicate with the agent, to reply to a message, to a specific message, and, you know, to get, you know, maybe we're talking in a channel and I want to reply on a message that was kind of like previously in that conversation. So I can reply to that thread and we can pass that entire thread to the agent. You can have buttons within these messages as well. So these conversations are also interactive. So you get all of the capabilities that an agent need basically out of the box in Slack.
And so it's only through Slack that your users can communicate. And how do you manage to make that first integration? So your first integration to build a product was just like, okay, let's just make it as simple as possible for your users and just like build it through Slack, or just like why not start with the email or something else? Because Slack is only, I mean, you're limiting yourself to only startups, because I think your product could be used also by tons of other companies and don't like, maybe they might be on Teams, on other Microsoft Teams or other IT environments. So why choose Slack specifically?
Yeah. So the misconception that entrepreneurs have usually at the beginning is that they need a big TAM, big target market. Okay. They don't. What they need is a clear path to eventually have a big target market. But at the beginning, they need to focus on a very small one. Okay. So it's very counterintuitive in that way, is that, you know, Swan, as you mentioned, could serve almost any business on planet Earth. That's amazing. That's super powerful. And that means that eventually we can grow into a massive company. But if you start serving all these customers from day one, then you'll end up, you know, giving a 60% service to all of them, right? So why don't you focus on a specific segment to give them a 100%, you know, a 200% experience, an 11-star experience, basically. And so we're not only focusing on Slack at the beginning, we're actually focusing on companies that have HubSpots as a CRM in Slack. They're targeting the US and Europe in terms of like their target market. So then mainly are focused on that. So we tried narrowing down our target market as much as we can, basically, to point that it makes sense that this type of segment requires a different value proposition. So we're working with small to medium businesses that work on HubSpot and Slack that are targeting North America and Europe. And, you know, potentially we could say, let's work on enterprises that are using Teams and Salesforce that are targeting, you know, EMEA, whatever. That will be a completely different segment that requires a very different type of, you know, solution for them. So what you need to look for basically is, yeah, you know, how can I build the smallest piece of value that will give, you know, the most impact on a specific segment?
Just to go back to how do you build an agent workflow, let's say, because I understand first one. Now, let's say you had to build it and prioritize another agent use case. Let's say you're targeting now, because you said just sell your service first. Let's say I want to sell my product. I want to build AI agents for, let's say, insurance companies. What's their, like, they wouldn't pay for an external service. They would pay directly for tech. How do you, let's say, compete with that and to the fact that the market is like very specific in a certain way to build your agents so that you can, yeah.
Yes.
Did I forget your question?
I see marketing, sales, and product, they all have different roles, basically. The way that you market your solution, you're almost independent. And I see today a lot of companies that they're marketing saying that they're building an AI agent. Right? If you ask their product won't say that it's really an AI agent. Their marketing, they're saying that's an AI agent. And sales can say a different thing. So, you know, when you position your solution to your potential buyer, then imagine, you know, how an 11-star experience would look like. What does it mean if I would fully build my solution? That is what you're selling at the beginning. You're selling the premise, the dream, basically. And then, you know, you're figuring out how to, you know, to deliver these core value propositions. And it's not that you're promising capabilities that you're not going to offer, you know, going to serve. So this is not a gray area. This is a red area. So you are promising capabilities that you can fulfill and you can provide to that customer. But when you, you know, explain the positioning of your solution, you want to, you know, dream big and you want to say, you know, that this is what you imagine it to be, basically. So you can call the same feature that you're, or the same value proposition, you can say that it's a, you know, we're a service agency, or we're a workflow automation solution, or we're an AI automation solution, or we're an agentic solution, or you could just pick whatever you'd like. Basically, it's the positioning that would fit your best. It's not like something is, someone is holding a gun to your head and saying, show me, prove it to me. It all would be a matter of what will happen when they meet your solution eventually, right? So if there's, you know, too much of a distance there, then it means that your marketing isn't working, right? But it's not like that. If it's services in the back end, you need to say to the customer that it's a services solution. They don't care about it. They just want to see something that they get. And if they feel like that the output is valuable and that an AI agent has produced it, they don't care that there was manual work behind the scenes, right? So in our case, we were doing a lot of manual work. And, you know, if you can think of a lead agency, you know, lead generation agency, that our work was pretty similar to what, you know, an AI lead generation agency would do. But we knew that eventually we're going to build a product to it. And we knew that this is how we want to position it to our customers. And we built like a very simple interface to it. Some things we would send over email. And there was a lot of work with send us a CSV and we will update the database and, you know, update your dashboard, etc. But still, it was a product in their sense.
So back to the maybe more the implementation phase for our listeners who have never like built an AI agent. Can you maybe like describe what makes a great agent? And if you were explaining it to a non-technical founder, how would you define maybe the anatomy of a high-performing agent? Like what benchmarks would you look at?
Yeah, so it's actually, it's very simple. And there's a difference, I think, to understand what's an agent, it's better to understand the difference between an agent and an AI automation. Okay. And I think that a lot of people kind of get confused between these two. And that's why we see all these companies that are calling themselves AI agents or agentic solutions, but they're not really agents. And first of all, like the difference between these two lies within the power balance of who controls the decision-making process within a given workflow. Okay. With AI automation, it's cool that kind of controls the decision-making process. And with an agent, it's the large language model, the AI that controls the decision-making process. We're going to break it down together. Don't worry if it sounds a little bit complex at the moment. But basically, it's agent comes from the word agency. It has the agency, kind of like the autonomy to make decisions on its own on how to use a set of tools that it has access to. So if we take, for example, the process of finding great leads, okay, in like a B2B database like Apollo, for example. So finding good leads and then personalizing a message to them and then sending out an email to them, right? So if this was an AI automation, it means that there is a software, a code that, you know, every time that that workflow starts, says, look, we need to bring leads from that database. That's the code telling us to do. And in that process, maybe there's an AI, you know, prompt that will get the leads basically and say, yeah, these are qualified, these are not qualified. But then the next step, the code will say, let's take these leads and now we need to personalize a message to them. And so maybe there's an AI step there that would say, yeah, okay, that's how we personalize the lead, et cetera, and take it to the next step. That's predetermined every time, 100% of the times that this workflow will run, it will kind of like follow these steps because the code is telling it to follow these steps. When there is an AI agent, basically, there isn't any code that is involved in that decision-making. There's a large language model. You explain in text to that large language model, you say, look, you have these three options. These are the three tools that you can use. You can find leads in a database. You can personalize a message to a lead, and you can put that lead in an email sequence. Now, I want you to use these tools in this particular order. That's how I would like you to use it, right? But if I would write something not really correct to the agent, then it might try to personalize a message before it find the lead because it has the agency to do it. So there's an AI agent that deciding what to do. And if it says, okay, the first thing that I want to do is to find qualified leads. So it will use that tool and that tool will be the same tool that we had in the previous example. It might be an AI that find leads, right? But the layer that decided to use it was the large language model. So what we're seeing is a shift in the power balance of who makes the decisions. Is it the code that humans wrote or is it the AI that, you know, sometimes could be a black box in that sense, that, you know, the large language model? And to influence the decision-making process in an AI automation, for example, we have like Zapier or NA10 or all these no-code tools that they can help you change the code that determines the steps and say, yeah, this is a step one, this is a step two, this is a step three. But when you're working with an agent, you cannot do that. What you can say, just tell it. You know what? I want you to start. Please, please, I beg you to start with step one. This is what I want you to do. Why are you not listening to me? That's how you work with an AI agent. It's completely different. So that's how you should look at, you know, agents versus automations in that sense. And sometimes it's better to build an AI automation and sometimes it's better to build an AI agent. And it's not like there's one that is more powerful than the other. They fit different use cases. And we can talk about that. That's interesting.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, like, for example, like how would you, like what framework would you use to say, you know, I need to build an AI agent versus an automation?
Yeah. So basically, if you have a process that is repeatable and it's like, it's the same thing that you have the same input basically, and you're expecting the same output always to be, then that's a very good use case for AI automation. Okay.
Yeah.
But if what happens, for example, and let's take this use case that I just gave, you know, lead finding leads in a database, personalizing a message to them and putting it in a sequence. Okay. So that specific process kind of can repeat itself and doesn't have a very complex use case. Okay. But what would happen if it would say, you know what? But if the lead that you find are from North America, okay, I want you to personalize in a different way. And I want you also to put it in a different email sequence. And if the leads that you find are from, you know, South America, I want you to do X. And if the leads, and then if you have all these use cases, for example, and it's not the same input and output, you start to have variants and a lot of use cases that you want that AI to support, then what you will find yourself building with the AI automation is that these complex decision trees, if this then that, if this then that, if this then that, and you kind of like find yourself building a beast of, you know, very complex logic conditions between each one of them. That means that you don't need a rule-based engine like AI automation. You need an intelligent agent that can just, you know, you need to tell it what to do. And what would take, you know, weeks and, you know, 20 different branches in an AI automation with an agent could just, you know, take you 2 minutes to say, yeah, you know what? If it's North America, this is what you want to do. If it's South Africa, this is what I want you to do. If it's this, you just write these six sentences and that's all you need basically to support this variance in use cases.
Yeah.
And so it's all about, you know, what we call the repeatability, similarity, and the variance of these use cases that you want to support. So that's kind of like the main differentiator. And there's another way to look at it if you'd like, but that's a very powerful one that I really like.
The one you just mentioning is just basically adding a layer of a large language model to just, on top of, or like you add a layer after each step basically and just saying like, you're going to double check if it's, so basically just like, let's say augmenting your decision tree, the decision tree of your agent, because you can say that AI automation are just not agents. It's just like, it's very simple agents. There's like agent level zero for me or level one. And that's why you have level two when you have to just let them, okay, so if it's this, and then the decision tree goes another way. And like if it's North America, it goes that way, et cetera, et cetera. And there's another layer after that, which is, I think, thinking about a strategy and taking decision, like they'd say for example, the lovable agents, or maybe it's one, I don't know, because lovable agents, they have like, it's basically MCPs, and there's, yeah, you add another, an extra layer also to that, to just generating your landing page or your whatever you want.
So I would argue that it's not like agent level zero and level one. There's a difference here, a fundamental difference. I will try to explain again how it works. Right. And we're going to get a little bit technical here. So just because, again, on that nuance, but basically, these large language models, they, in the last 6 months or so, or even a little bit more, 12 months, they've built a capability that's called tool calling, okay, to call tools, okay? So instead of trying to build these decision trees, Jonathan, what you can do is you can connect tools to the large language model itself. So you can actually say, you know what, Claude, for example, right? That's like the model of Anthropic. You can say, look, you can now search in my CRM, okay? This is a tool that I give. I didn't tell you how to use that tool. You could just use it, okay? And then you could also use this tool to perform online research, okay? So and it's a real use case. At Swan, our agent has a tool to read and write into the CRM, has a tool to research online, to use Perplexity, actually, to research online, okay? It has a tool to send a Slack DM. It has a tool to personalize a message. It has all these tools, and all these tools are always available to that agent, okay? Then, in the prompt, I can just tell the agent, look, in this case, this is how I want you to use this tool. And in this case, this is how I would like you to use this tool. And the entire layer is the large language model basically gets your prompt and it will output a prompt that will trigger these tools, basically. These are API calls that the large language model will write a text to them. It will say, look, basically, I want to trigger the CRM tool. I want to trigger that tool. So whenever the decision-making process of which tool to use is generated through tokens of the LLM, of the large language model, and not by code that decides that this is when you need to use it, it's an agent. And in the example you gave, Jonathan, in the decision tree, when you add another AI step, so it means that 100% of the time, the code will always push it in the same direction. It will just push it sometimes to an AI to ask it, what do you think? But the next step be the same next step because that's what the code decided. So it's a different architecture where all the logic of the decision-making process is pre-written in the code itself,
right?
But when you're building an agent, all the logic of the decision-making process is built into the prompt.
Okay, so it's very much like logic-based from what I understood using the prompt you are making. So very interesting, but like I know we are short on time and you have like an amazing like GTM strategy. I wanted to talk to you about that. So I saw like you have zero paid ads. How do you turn impression into qualified meetings and deals if you have zero paid ads? How does that work exactly?
Kind of go back a little bit to the earlier in the conversation. So, you know, at Swan, we first iterated on the demand, right? Instead of just working on the product, we invested very heavily in creating a demand, creating audience to like what we want to talk about. And what really works for me specifically, and that's kind of like a very core aspect of the autonomous business methodology, is that we're not trying to take agents that will replace our work. We're actually trying to empower ourselves. So we tried looking at me as like, you know, the solo go-to-market person in the team. How can we turn Amos into the 100x version of themselves by building AI agents around Amos specifically? And my passion is in storytelling and writing great content on LinkedIn that generates a lot of noise, basically. A lot of, you know, I generate consistently over 1 million impressions every month. And so we realized we need to capitalize on that, basically. So how can you build an AI agent army around that? So the first thing we did is not like say, oh, it would be cool to do like that, or let's do X or let's do Y. We didn't do that. We actually identified like, where's the biggest bottlenecks that I have right now, basically. And so the first bottleneck was that I spent so much time in writing these posts. And it could take up to 50% of my time just thinking and writing about these posts. So we built Shakespeare as the first agent that can really help me as an extension of my mind to, you know, write better posts at, you know, half the time, basically. So that was kind of like the first agent that we built. And then what happened is that, you know, over 1 million impressions, I got over 15,000 reactions on my posts from, you know, every month from leads that are, you know, might be relevant, some of them, but I couldn't go over that, right? It's too much. So we build the Observer, which is an agent that, you know, monitors these LinkedIn posts and identifies hot ICP leads that are interacting with me, pushing them to Slack, basically, and enable me to reach out to them in a very thoughtful way. Then another bottleneck, you know, unveiled itself where I got over 300 connection requests each day, right? So that's a lot of inbound traffic coming. So we said, wait, what can we do with that? We've built, you know, the connector, which goes over these connection requests, filters non-relevant leads and enable me to reach out to the hottest, you know, leads that are, you know, reaching out to me, basically. And after that, we, you know, we saw, okay, there's so many traffic coming to our website. Over 10,000 people every month coming to our website, but we're not converting most of them. So what can we do with all this anonymous website visitors? So we used Swan to build the hunter that, you know, monitors all that website activity, de-anonymize the leads that are not converting so that we know who they are, qualifies them, and reaches out to them in a very personalized way so we can kind of like, you know, recapture some of the traffic that didn't really convert. And so like the list goes on in terms of like the agents. We have an agent that we call the gatekeeper. So folks that did visit the website and converted into request access. So we have an agent that, you know, researches them and monitors and then routes them to their best place, either like a free trial, a waiting list, or to a demo with me. Then for the demos that I do take, We have an agent that briefs me for the calls and, you know, make sure that I only spend time on, you know, the actual call without preparation. Then we have another agent that generates tasks and follow-ups, et cetera. So if you can see, it's like a funnel that every step we had unveiled kind of like a bottleneck that we had, and we just built an agent to solve for that specific bottleneck.
Yeah. It's amazing how you're breaking down like every step of the way and thinking, you know, how can I build an agent to take care of it? But do you apply, like, for example, do you apply this mindset in like elsewhere, for example, in your business or maybe in your personal life? Like, how can I build an agent to automate this? Is that the right framework mindset to adopt in that case?
Yeah. So I would actually say that it's not the right mindset, Matteo, but it's a great question, and I would explain why. Because I believe that in the biggest misconception that I see right now is that people are trying to automate processes. And what they should be doing is empower a specific human being rather than trying to look at the process. So when you change that perspective, when you look at the human being at the center, you ask yourself, what things should that human being do? And what things, what processes should the AI could help with, right? And so it's a more holistic point of view that puts the human in the center, because we don't believe that AI agents just float around in outer space without anyone in charge of them. They're always tied to a person that is in charge of a metric that they want to move. Maybe they want to get more meetings booked. Maybe they want to get more pipeline. Maybe they want to improve customer support. Doesn't matter. There's always a person at the end of that loop. And we believe that, you know, the people would be the ones that are, you know, running these AI agents, right? Not vice versa. Until, you know, in the near future, let's say the next 5 years, maybe after that, you know, the tables will change. But as long as we're superiors, these AI agents, there's a human being at the center. And I always think of it as, okay, who's that person? And the more personal we can get, the more powerful the agents would be. Because if you look at my use case, it's very unique to, like, who am I and what are my challenges and strengths and weaknesses? And it's built tailored to me. And so the more tailored it is to the workforce, to the talent that you have in the company, then the more you can 100x yourself. And if you remember, that's the goal here. And when you look at, you know, automating a process, then what you can get is maybe 50% increase in efficiency. That's great. That's nice. A lot of companies are looking for that. And I'm not, you know, underestimating that. But if you can get a 100x improvement over the productivity of a person, that's much more powerful than that. And so that's what we're looking to do, basically, to empower the human being at the center of the AI implementation.
That's super interesting, because it's kind of the approach we have with colleague in my company, Orbital Agents. We also go from, so you always go back to kind of a very personalized approach for each client in the end. Each human, like, 100%. Yeah. That's funny. And so what does your organizational, let's say, chart of flow look like today with Swan? Like, so you have three founders, you're trying to scale to 30 million AR, so 10 million per employee. Like, how far are you from the objective you just set yourself, like, now 6 months later? And what's your organization?
I would say that it would take us, I would say, maybe 2 more years to get to that threshold. Maybe a year and a half if we're super optimistic, but at least that. We're not, you know, it's not about staying three people all the way up. It will always be a small, super lean, flat organization. And it's about, you know, the goal of getting to $10 million ARR per employee. The organization is built on three core functions that we believe that this is the core function that an autonomous business should have. One is a revenue creator, which is me, that is in charge of the entire customer life cycle, you know, from demand generation, sales to success. Then we have the product creator, which is in charge of, you know, creating the product itself and is working with a lot of AI agents to actually build that product. And then we have the third function, which is the agent creator, which is supposed to help these two functions scale with intelligence, not with headcount. So I'm not the one building all these agents, right? And I don't have time. I need to grow revenue, right? We have Ido, my co-founder, who's the agent creator, who is building these agents for me so I can, you know, scale my revenue operations with intelligence, not with headcount. And he does the same thing for product. And we could scale these functions, but maybe we'll bring another agent creator. Maybe we'll bring another revenue creator to that sense. But there will still be, you know, a sub 10 people organization that only has these three functions. And what we can make sure is that the agent creators can support the both product and revenue creators so they can scale indefinitely with, you know, the existing headcount.
So super interesting what you mentioned. And it reminds me of, like, previously, if you look at like early, like older startups, what you call like an agent creator, like it reminds me of a chief operating officer. So maybe let's say, you know, like I want to work in operation, you know, in my startup, instead of being like a chief operating officer, I should learn how to build agents to operate for me. Is that right from what I understood?
Yeah, so it is right. I would say that what used to be ops, so ops is a very generic term these days, and it can mean a lot of different things for different companies, because we have, like, you know, ops that are super oriented towards revenue, but then we have ops that are super oriented towards even like more like internal processes like HR or finance or things like that, right? So it can mean a lot of different things. But definitely, you know, if you're working at a company and you find yourself as the ops person that is powering a lot of the revenue generation efforts or product efforts, then it means that you can kind of like, you know, crawl yourself into the position of being that agent creator and building agents to help these organizations grow faster without, you know, scaling their headcount. So definitely it's similar to ops, but it's a new function in the way that it should be dedicated to building AI agents to support the organization scale with intelligence, not with headcount.
Amazing. And now some founders or some companies are still having a hard time, like, just like delegating their work and to AI agents, because they might be losing their team's creative spark. So how do you think about keeping the human magic while scaling intelligence? Because you said you're like fully booked on like all the closing and the sales cycles. Your other co-founder is fully booked and has no time for thinking other things than just building a product. And your other co-founder has nothing else, is fully booked on just maintaining and scaling the AI agents for the team. How do you find time and just like to be more creative and like think about the next steps of Swan and how to scale the company, you know, that founder mindset?
It's a great question. And maybe the biggest challenge of them all right now is time. Wish we would invented an agent that could give me more time. Doesn't exist. So managing time is crucial. I would say that a lot of CEOs, you know, of startups are handling this issue as well, you know, trying to prioritize your time as well. And it's never easy, especially if you're trying to scale that much with a 30-person team. But not necessarily that we have more in our plate than other teams out there. It's just because, you know, when you hire people, they don't give you a break of your work. It's not like, you know, when you hire a support team, then it means that you have more time for yourself. You just need to manage that support team right now, right? So it's my time just is being spent not on managerial efforts and hierarchies and bureaucracies and approvals. It's just more spent on execution. But you mentioned something super important here, Jonathan, that I would like to kind of, you know, maybe give like a closing note with it, about how do you find time to be creative? And if you kind of like look closely, the three functions within the autonomous business share one thing. They are all creators. Okay. They're agent creator, revenue creator, and product. Why we chose these, you know, this title carefully, because we believe that in an AI native world, the job of the human being is to create and to be creative. And that's what they spend most of their time. And when they have AI that can execute on everything, they spend their time at, you know, creative tasks to create, you know, net new from zero and, you know, strategize. And so all of these functions are creators, and they spend most of their time doing creation.
Super interesting. It touches a very, like, very deep point about the, like, the role of human beings in 5 years or 30 years, 10 years from now. Like, what will we be doing? But it's a bit far, so we're not there. Just to wrap up, you know, I know we are short on time. If you had, like, maybe one piece of advice to a young founder starting out on how to go from zero to one in 2025, what would it be?
Start a services company and try to sell something before you build it. And once you do, try to productize the service that you actually managed to sell. And that is an amazing formula to build a great business in the age of AI. It wasn't that like that until today. But today, what AI can offer you basically is to take a human intensive service and replace it with a productized version of an AI that does a lot of that. So just try to sell something that you build a service for. And if you manage to do that, you did like 90% of the work.
That's cool. Now we have some quick questions to close up the episode. Just answer with the sharpest answer you can give us. So the most underrated founder skill today?
Perseverance.
One tool or framework that you find irreplaceable?
I don't know. Ditch the frameworks, think first principles and try to, invent your own. We're living in an era that, experience doesn't worth a lot. Everything is getting invented like at every second, basically. So, just follow your instincts.
Favorite read, podcast, I think, lately?
I love the All In podcast.
It's a great one.
I love hearing Chamath and David fight over stupid shit. So, yeah, definitely.
One hard lesson you learned the hard way.
Believe in yourself because no one else would if you don't.
Advice to a 20-year-old founder in 2025?
Question. The shortcut is sometimes the longest road.
I agree with that one.
I think you have to figure this out on your own. But and last question, and then we're done. What else do you think we should interview on zero to one, especially to explore, the agentic business era? I know, for example, Maor Shlomo, who is also an Israeli, like sold a startup for $80 million. Like, who would you recommend, like people like him?
Yeah, so Maor is an amazing guy. And he knows about, scaling super fast, a small lean team. Also you have, other founders who are building similar ways as well out there, but Maor is an amazing example. Yeah.
Okay. You think you know him?
Not personally. No.
Okay. It might be hard to get him. And if you know someone that you would recommend personally, who would that be? Besides Maor.
I don't have anything at the top of my head right now.
Found a friend? No. Okay. No worries.
No worries.
Thank you so much, Amos. It was great having you on the episode.
That's it for this episode of 01. If this gave you an idea, an edge, or the courage to build, send it to your friend, founder, or your team. Follow us, subscribe, and drop us a DM if there's someone you want to hear next. Until then, keep building, keep shipping, and go from 0 to 1.